The Guardian.
Before you get started with this edition of the Books podcast, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now, on with the show.
You what? You did what? Where do you think you are? You're in South fucking London.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books Podcast with me, Claire Armitstead. This week we have another Guardian Live event for you, looking at how to write a London novel.
I think you write a great London novel or a good London novel by writing about the things that you love and the things that you're obsessed with.
With much ripe language and, alas, not consistently wonderful sound quality, London-obsessed writers A.L. Kennedy, Will Self and Tony Parsons joined Mark Lawson for a rather rackety journey through the metropolis and the distinguished history of the literature inspired by it. We join them as Will Self, being his usual provocative self, lays out his stall to A.L. Kennedy.
You know, you can be objective about this, Alison, and objectively, London is top city. just in hard statistical terms, it surfs the zeitgeist of the first phase of globalisation and is the cynosure of world trade, both financial and physical, throughout the late 19th and into the 20th century. And now it's reassumed that position again. And that is exactly the period of the megapolis urbanisation in the West. Yeah, there are bigger cities, and yeah, there are cities that have been more important at different times. And of course, if you want to take a complete kind of Needham question view of the whole thing, then everything's China anyway, so what's the point in bothering? But actually, if you look at things just, say, from a Western hemispheric perspective, London is top city historically. And actually, there's a good case to be made for it being top city in an important sense culturally, in terms of the Western canon as well, in terms of what it embodies and its institutions, its literature, and so on.
This is always what happens. You've got three blokes in a suit, and we're all white, and we're all middle class. And we're all talking about one of the most diverse and multicoloured and multi-ethnic and multi-sexual cities in the world.
That's a comparatively recent phenomenon.
But it's now. It is.
Yeah, but you're talking about a city that's 2,000 years old. That's just an eye blink.
Yeah, but so much about London is about a very small view of London. And I mean, some of the things that you're saying that are true about London, I know why it's a megalopolis, I would say, from the point of view of enjoying the experience of living there and surviving if you're poor, and surviving if you're experiencing the London struggle, make London unsurvivable and make London this crushing, empty investment opportunity rather than a wonderful city, and rather than many of the things that I love about London that I loved when I read about it, in the way that I loved St. Petersburg before I ever went there because I read about it. Even when I read Hangover Square, the mysterious kind of torment of that was wonderful. And when I read Muriel Spark, the extraordinary shabbiness and weirdness and loveliness and quirkiness and availability and odd ramshackleness of it was fantastic. And now it's the oligarchs and the multiple skyscrapers and the no skyline.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, you're the unbreathable air. You know, what are you talking about? You're talking about a very short period of municipal socialism.
Talking about the period during which I am occupying this city and people are trying to live in it.
But historically you're talking about a very, very small period in history.
You know, obviously, but, you know, it's probably going to be the lifespan of a human being, which is probably the more merciful perspective to take.
I think the whole point about cities is, you know, John Gray, the philosopher, says, in the city, the human subject can feel himself to be but a shadow cast by the buildings. So the long view is essential for the city writer. If that's your perspective, it's not all zeitgeisty. You must feel the shadow, man. Feel your own evanescence.
I feel the shadow.
I don't know if that comforts the people who are going to be sleeping outside.
It's not, but we're not in the business of comforting. Have I ever been in the business of comforting?
We're going to chat for a bit longer, and then we've got two microphones, and we'll open it up to the audience. Going back to this, Will said that you need to know the place, but there are two types, I mean, of writing about a city, aren't there? The ones from people who've been there a long time, and then people come in. As I was walking across Waterloo Bridge today, a lot of lines from The Wasteland came into my head.
How many?
Well, I can't tell you how many. I do not know much about gods, but I think the river is a dark brown god. But then I thought of that one where...
Did you walk round and round King William Street in a ring then?
Yeah, King William Street, and you see them. But the thing about Eliot that struck me was that he was seeing it. There's a section in the Wasteland where he just lists place names and churches, and that's an outsider, an American, finding these places.
He's a
exotic.
Great London writer, though.
Yeah, he really is, but as an outsider, though,
he gets it.
I think if you're at a certain point, you sort of get the way that you, in particular, are a writer, and you feed in the things that are quite likely to happen. So if, for example, you travel at all, you pay attention and try not to do cheap travel writing, or you get very interested and then you do, okay, am I going to do newly arrived or here forever? When you come to London, do you, you know, what's your focus? What kind of research are you doing? Is it present day? Is it past? What's resonating? What isn't resonating? So, again, it's a research project like any other research project, but it will also reflect what you feel is important about the world, whether it's humanity or some other thing. And I knew I was coming to London, but I knew that I wanted to write about politics, I knew that I wanted to write about Parliament, and if you don't know, you find out. But
you could always become a Londoner. I mean, you could become a Londoner the way you couldn't become English. One of my favourite London anecdotes is Paul Weller, the musician, coming up from Woking in Sussex when he was a teenager, and just recording the sounds of the city on his little cassette, you know, because he had that kind of diaspora longing, that Cockney diaspora longing for the city.
What I love, and I mean, it happened on a... Are you offended by swearing?
Fuck no.
I just love, there's something about, and I mean, I'm going out with the South Londoner, but there's something about that particular song of South London and being on a train. And I mean, for that book, what I wanted to do was to go all the way around and look at, instances of kindness between strangers. But because London partly floats on those, because it's almost intolerable without it, because we have to be merciful or we don't survive, we're group animals. So I was going around looking at these examples, and they're all based on reality, the ones that I put in the book. But just hearing this sort of male angry noise in a crowded Ginger Line train, and you're thinking, oh no, it's a drunk and it's daytime, oh, that would be so tedious. But the more you heard the detail of it, it was this beautiful aria from this guy who was obviously just coming back from a job or going to a job with his apprentice, standing over a guy going, you what? You did what? Where do you think you are? Where do you think you are? You're in South fucking London. You don't talk to a woman like that. That could be your mother. That could be your sister. What the fuck do you want to get off? Should we discuss this? It's this beautiful, and he never drew, when he drew breath, his apprentice, who was his apprentice in every way, would say, and I've got a mum. And the woman they were defending is sitting there going, oh, swallow me up. Oh, please don't bother. And this poor, some kind of man who is insufficiently properly South Londonly manly was going, it's like, it was wonderful. It's like, this is South fucking London. You don't come here. We won't tolerate fucking cunts like
that's
you.
That's not an instance of kindness, is it?
He was defending. He was defending. He was chivalrously defending a lady from
if he'd have been properly versed in the ways of conflict resolution, he could have persuaded the chauvinistic man of the error of his ways and comforted the wronged woman. But instead, he chose a typical South London display of ridiculous machismo braggadocio, which you, in any other context, would not endorse.
No. That was the sound of somebody who could be extremely physically violent deciding to be pleasant.
Well, then you're patronising them. You're patronising them
No. That was within his...
But anyway, and if you need to do the retroactive thought exercise. If you were to imagine a capital of England that was a global city, what would it be like? London, probably. So, you know, if she does all fit together, and then look at the great London writers of the past. They're not super London-y. They've all been in and out of it. So I think some of my favourite London writing De Quincey's Confessions of an English Opium Eater, very much about a man coming in and out of the city, coping with it, not coping with it, fucking up. Defoe's Journal of the Plague Year, a very great early work of the kind of psychogeography of the city. Again, a similar sense of movement. Dickens, of course. Jack London's People of the Abyss. You know, Tony says he's a child of the Cockney diaspora. The Cockney diaspora begins year dot. London in 1903 is talking about the Cockney householder running ahead of a tide of speculative building towards Essex, and also being pushed out by the new Jewish immigrants coming into the East End at the time. So, you know, back to it again, take the long view, feel the flux and the influx, and feel this incredible, you know, London is much more like a giant oyster or some sort of bivalve sucking in stuff from everywhere, but mostly from England. The big population flows into the city historically, and I think probably still to this day even, are from its own hinterland. That's where the people come from.
I'm not sure that's true.
It certainly was historically.
Yeah, historically, but it feels like young people that are doing the kind of things that we've done all our life are struggling to stay in the city.
No, well, that's certainly true.
It's funny, so you mentioned journalists living outside, but I know meet a lot of actors, and most actors now can't live in London, even if they're appearing in at London theatres. So, and it's become an issue because they have to get them in and out of, you know, people are delayed on trains and so on.
Oh, no, it can't go on.
Well, yeah, everything but changes, but you have to do something, you know, you have to have some kind of
I think
influence.
Probably another major crash, because the asset bubble is there, and it's just because it's been squeezed and pushed and largely pseudo-inflated by money supply adjustments. But what does that mean? I've been thinking about this a lot recently, and I'll give you my wisdom. It's a debt on the future. So when people realise how most of the fungible assets are actually threatened, there's going to be a catastrophic fall in all of these long-term bonds and the associated assets as well. They must go, and majorly. Yeah. So, you know, you may laugh last and hardest if you don't have London property, because you'll be looking at a lot of sore twats who thought they were going to cash their chips.
Before I open up, I was going to talk about great London writers. Will's mentioned several. T.S. Eliot, we mentioned. John Sullivan, I would add, TV writer. Only Fools and Horses, Citizen Smith. Only Fools and Horses,
Ray
great.
Davis, I would add.
Yeah,
Ray
great
Davis.
London comedy. Ray Davis, yeah.
Waterloo Sunset. Is a man who's dedicated his life to
Hawksmoor, tremendous, Well, and many others.
And I do think the Book of Dave is one of the great London novels.
Well,
so anybody
that's
interested in the city should.
Thank you, Tony. I appreciate that.
Any other London writers before we end?
Mid-period, My Name Is, wrote about it when he was also writing about LA and Hollywood and, you know, a man bouncing between continents and cities.
Because pretty much all early Martin Amis is set in a small, around Ladbroke Grove, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quite a micro vision, it has to be said. But it is, you know, it's good. But Patrick Hamilton, you were talking about earlier, Tony, is well worth.
Really stomach churning. Dan Franklin read his second novel and it made him want to be sick. Was it I Was Laura Sanchez? He died with his
Derek
eyes.
Cook.
Yeah.
That's
kind of.
Yeah.
Kind of. But actually, you know, there's lots of people. Yeah, I think what London doesn't. You know, the thing is, we got so many shit hot writers and they've all set stuff here. Think about Huxley. There's loads of Huxley set in London. And actually, something like. Brave New World is actually a fantastic London novel. Going by Flivver to play clock golf at Stoke Poges. You know, I mean, it's very rooted in the city. 1984,
of course,
written on Jura, but the Senate House is the Ministry of Truth, and so on.
Broadcasting House, they're all
there. Stinkingly London-y. He was living in Kentish Town at the time, and people who went round to visit him were alarmed when he'd smash up chairs and shove them in the fire because he was skinned.
And it's interesting, there always seem to be new London novels to be written, because New York, for example, I mean, it can be done, but there's a slight nervousness now that it's all been said. But it's to do with the rate of change.
It's changing hugely, and just the globalisation of the planet, and the fact that a lot of people like living in London. They like the schools and they like the parks. It's such a fantastically green city. You know, it's
well, I mean, it's a lot of cultural capital that's speedily being amortized and sold. And guess what? It'll run out for obvious reasons. You know, wake up and smell the coffee. People aren't going to overvalue London indefinitely in that way.
And you're not getting the New York novel in the same way because they've kind of all been infantilized by MA creative writing courses. So you're waiting for people who haven't been poisoned to come in and write. And there are a lot of people coming into London who haven't been through that place your metaphor here thing. Or, you know, let's write another 30-something novel about somebody writing a novel about a 30-something person in the village. Please don't do that again.
But I don't think that's happening, Alison, at all. I don't get, I mean, we're all really old. Where are these young London writers coming up of vast cosmopolitanism, writing these incredible... Where are they? Most of the people in the room are old as well. They won't know. We're all old.
Try,
I don't know
try
what
reading the last...
Like a young hot...
There's Lunderstan, isn't there? He wrote Lunderstan.
There are loads, yeah. Having just judged the last Granter Best of Young British Under 40 Novelist list, well, I thought I might be interested in literature. I mean, there is a lot of stuff out there.
And what was it like?
It was astonishing, but almost everything was coming from outside the UK, from different extremities of experience.
Was it any good?
Yeah, there was some stonking stuff.
But it's not by, dare I say, indigenous writers of any kind.
They were indigenous to somewhere. Do you mean that they come from somewhere else?
You're saying they're not real Londoners?
No, not at all. No, I'm just wondering what people are writing. Alison's
got the... But what
do
you mean by indigenous, though?
What?
What do you mean by indigenous?
Were they born here?
Right. Some of them not. Some of them first generation, some of them, you know, fifth generation, whatever.
But they're from different heritages, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and a lot of things about displacement, about identity, about...
Well, fair play.
Lots of different friction. There was some, it was very exciting, actually. There's almost no coverage of books in television, in the papers. People don't really get reviewed. Making a list is a terrible solution to that problem, but at least it gives some new writers a little bit of oxygen. Yes, it's totally invidious, but everybody judging it is trying to make it as useful as possible.
A couple of newspaper editors of whole newspapers, have basically banned fiction reviews, haven't they? They only want non-fiction.
Yeah, it's awful, and the situation in Scotland is even worse. Yeah,
I warned
it's
about
terrible.
This years ago, but you wouldn't listen.
Did you
warn
us well?
In this very effing newspaper, I warned everybody some years ago what to expect, but they wouldn't listen.
Yeah.
And now look at you all bleating about it.
They're all grinning. They look terrible.
Look, we have healthy. two microphones at the each side of the room. So who would like to start us off?
Hi, Will and I are colleagues at Brunel University, and I recently finished teaching an undergraduate course on the literature of London. I was wondering, people on the panel, if you had the chance to curate such a course, what would your canonical texts be?
Jeez, I think we've...
Well, we mentioned lots of them. I think Money, the Rachel Papers, The Wasteland, Hangover Square.
You can tell a lot about the history of London through its crime. I mean, there was a wonderful exhibition at the Museum of London, which was about one room in New Scotland Yard. Room 101, the Black Museum, and that is such a fantastic history of the city, and from Islamic terror back through the Crays and the Richardsons all the way back to the
but you've got to curate books, Tony, actual books.
I think if you look at the sub Dickens writers. You forget how funny the Victorians were. And you forget how crazy, you know, going to the Vauxhall Pleasure Gardens, it's like Sodom and Gomorrah almost immediately. Well, and there are lots of books. I'm very good at remembering titles, but not very good at remembering names. But Valentine Vaux, slightly sub Dickens, but still very funny, still very playful, full of London and all the very peculiar ways of getting around and the different ways of being able to meet people within a society where you weren't allowed to meet people, and different ways of being sexual with people when that was so difficult. And a great thing called The Bachelor of Albany, about a bachelor who lives in Albany, which obviously is still there and is, you could write a novel about Albany. But again, incredibly
funny.
There's
one called The Albany Murders, I think. There's an early crime novel. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you could just...
Conan Doyle.
Yeah.
The Sign of Four is the best description of the building of South London suburbia that there is in literature. Conan Doyle is a master at describing London's built environment. J.G. Ballard's Crash. Ballard never liked to be thought of as a London novelist and believed that he was completely decentered and just off. But actually, I taught it the other day to our students, Crash. He's very London.
And he didn't, of course, he didn't come here until, he didn't come to the country until he was 16.
So. Well, in fact, he used to lie about that.
Alison mentioned Muriel Spark. I mean, if you ever want to do a course that you can have all the postal, I mean, all the districts of London, Far Cry from Kensington is tremendous.
Ballad
of Peckham Rye, they're all in there. And one of the things, which is given what we're talking about, the context of this, how expensive London now is, I think someone said this earlier, the constant theme in Muriel Spark's fiction is how cheaply you can live in London. I mean, it keeps coming back. Yeah. And then P.D. James, late P.D. James novel,
and
A Certain Justice.
John Le Carre. John Le Carre
wrote Graham Greene and John Le Carre.
London and one of those.
London, Graham by Greene. Michael Moorcock, which is a sort of... And actually, I think it qualifies as a literary work, is Aykroyd's London, A Biography, which is a superb...
But the descriptions of London, particularly by the Thames in P.D. James' A Certain Justice, are amazingly good. I mean, she's a great writer of place, I think.
I've never read P.D. James. I once shared a cab with her, though, and she was such an old dragon. I thought, I'm never reading your fucking book. She's right up herself. She'd been given her DBE by Thatcher, and it was like a broom up her back rectum. There's certain people who not only shouldn't get honours, they should actually be smeared publicly with excreta and beaten through the streets, somewhat as they did in the days when Newgate was operated.
Poor old Baroness James. A woman of famous sweetness, and you obviously... She got you on a bad day, or vice versa. But,
I don't know. Was she the famous sweetness?
Yeah,
Oh, well, I remember, because we were published by both published by Penguin in the 90s, and I remember that she wasn't that nice to the little people, Mark.
That can't be true. She was published by Faber for her entire life. She was Why
would I have run across her then?
I don't know. You're not mixing around with somebody else, are you?
Well, you know what? Your memory is undoubtedly...
Oh, there were Penguin paperbacks, weren't there?
Thank you.
Before Faber did. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Because I
she was a Penguin.
Worry about my memory.
Anyone on this side who would like to grab Lindell's microphone and...
What are the clichés of the London novel? What should be avoided by London novelists?
Well, I mean, I think what the discussion, if it's revealed anything, is that we don't really think that it's the kind of city, and this is, I think... You know, this little discussion about the New York novel, and I don't think there is a distinctively London novel in quite that way. I mean, I think, you know, in other words, I think the city's so big and looms so large that you can treat it as a world entire. So it's the same problems that you have with any novel of place. Cliché is the endless enemy. Whatever the cliché is, it has to be avoided.
It's an interesting question, because the notorious cinematic one, which is the red bus and the black cab going round... Yeah. Well, I think you can, Palace. Are there literary equivalents of that?
Well, there are. I mean, I cashed in my pension and took a couple of years off so I could write my first crime book without a contract. And I thought deeply about avoiding, how do you avoid clichés? How do you avoid the clichés of the crime novel? And to me, one of the great clichés about the London crime novel is it would be set in Scotland Yard. And so you just have to, you know, you just have to get your inner ear to avoid anything that seems as though it's been done to death to you. I mean, my novels are set in West End Central, and because one of the first pieces of journalism that I ever did after, you know, staying up with Iggy Pop all night for a few years, was writing about the Vice Squad in West End Central, which is in Savile Row, which is a strange little street full of nothing but bespoke tailors and this massive, great police station. And so I knew it, and it seemed like a good way to swerve the cliché. So, you know, you just develop that ear. You know when something has been done to you. If you're writing a London novel, you know when something's a cliché. If you feel that it's been done to death, you know, it's not just specific to the London novel, but the...
Rhyming slang is one of them, isn't it? Because writers that come from outside, particularly Americans, they become obsessed with rhyming slang.
Yeah.
And they have lots of dialogue about, do you want to walk up the apples and pears and all that
although,
kind of stuff?
You know, although it can still be used, you know, you can still use it, but...
It changes, doesn't it, amazingly?
Yeah.
Yeah,
everybody was getting fucked up.
He is what Britain is for a while,
everybody was getting fucked up the Gary for a while.
Do you want to cross that one?
No.
No.
If you don't know, you shouldn't be here.
Well, I mean, it would be the same rules apply, really, that you're trying to make the people unique people and then it will become more unique, and if your voice is unique, it will seem less cliched. But
it's like any... You've got to go and listen to the dialogue live. I mean, the problem with most written dialogue is that there's no relation to how anybody speaks. So, you know, it's kind of, let alone native Londoners of whatever stripe. I'm sorry I said the word native again. Don't get me wrong, it's not some sort of weird Nigel Farage attack that's taken me over. I don't give a shit who lives here, and I actually believe in completely open borders. I couldn't give a toss. It makes me hoot with laughter. The idea that the Windsors, for example, might be turfed out of their ugly Thomas Cubitt house. That would be great, wouldn't it?
I mean, certainly from outside London, some of what you might think of as the London cliché, you know, the Richard Curtis palette, but that's a lot of sort of middle-class clichés.
Weird cliché, wasn't it? Because it was a London that didn't actually exist and possibly never had done, but it was one that he invented.
Oh, no, I think it was entirely accurate. I know that London. I'm a man of many parts, and some of them are rag-rolled and stippled.
Well, where it always snows and...
I've been there. I mean, admittedly, in a K-hole, but, I mean, you know. No, it does exist, that kind of rag-rolled kind of girls who live in Chiswick and drive mini clubmen. I mean, I'm going back a few years. But they've been around for a while. Yeah, no, it's very real. And they don't really, of course, live in the actual London. They live sort of between here and the country, and they're
always
coming and
going. Yeah, you commute, and you've got a country place.
So they're living in this kind of... Again, it's a different sort of place. I mean, the city's big enough to inhabit these alternate realities.
Having a dog called Toby.
Le Carre said it's not, you know, because he still writes about the secret world and all that, but he hasn't actually, you know, he did that for a few years and then he's been a writer for half a century. And he said that the important thing is not authenticity, but credibility. So you just have to believe in, and a lot of the language of Le Carre, he invented, you know, and then it feeds back into the culture, like, Sopranos quoting The Godfather and Goodfellas.
Oh, yeah, well, the greatest story about that. I mean, the Spooks love Le Carre because, of course, they're absolutely, if you've ever met Spooks, they're devoid of imagination. They have no, that's why they're Spooks. So the idea that anybody could invent anything and associate with, so they just take it on. Mm. They all talk in stuff they've learned out of Le Carre. It's hilarious. But by the same token, they got a tape, they had a wiretap on the New Jersey Mafia, and one of the wiretap conversations was them discussing the Sopranos and saying that the script writers must have a plant in the family because the dialogue was so accurate. They said, who have they got? Who do you think is feeding them this stuff? So just go and, you know, take your tape recorder and listen.
Yeah.
Tony and I are big Ian Fleming fans, and actually those moments in the Bond books where he comes back to London, usually from somewhere incredibly exotic, I think those are tremendous little bits of London
and
writing. And you get the clubs and the
and he lives.
Politics.
I mean, he lives in the in Bond lives in the
Chelsea,
London of Ian Fleming, and he couldn't. You know, he's living in some fancy gaff, and he's driving his, he's a civil servant, you know, he's a civil servant, and yet it works, and you believe in, my guy in these cry books lives in a loft in Smithfield, and somebody said, well, he couldn't possibly live in a loft in Smithfield because he couldn't afford it, you know, a young single parent cop couldn't afford to live, but you meet strange people. I know people that that were in care that will inherit £10 million homes because of who adopted them. There are all these weird anomalies that you get in London that I think you clearly you get a lot less of elsewhere because it's not so much money knocking around. Fleming is another great London writer.
There are certain kind of structural oddities about London that encourage these fictional, exactly as you say, Tony, if you think about it, the fact that you can't legally know who owns anything in London, it's actually kind of interesting that there's no... So it means that whenever you're looking at something, you don't know who's alienating it from you. So there's that kind of unknowingness, I think.
There's this the rumour about this massive great place that's being built, the most expensive house in London being built on the edge of the Heath. And is it Putin? Is it, it's obviously someone at that high table, but we don't know.
And I think people reinvent themselves a lot in the city. That's why they come to cities and why they, and I think that the rate of, again, of change in people is phenomenal. You tend to assume in a naive way that people remain the same in their lives. So it's a bit like if you think of the names in Dickens. The names in Dickens aren't particularly made up by Dickens. People did have those funny Dickensian names in the Victorian last names, and they've all kind of changed a bit. And people don't kind of get that sort of sense of movement in time and also in individual lives. And one of the big problems, I think, in literature is capturing the movement of time, really, in that way.
But that sense of shadow, Len Deighton does it as well. All of that, the Len Deighton, Graham Greene, that sense of some shadow entity, I think is really good to insert in London because it is so huge that there are so many possibilities. And you do come, coming from a very, very, very small town where everybody knew exactly who you were and where you'd been and who your dad was. It's fantastic to come, even for a small amount of time, to London because, you can be whoever and you're constantly on a mission that's secret or peculiar or whatever you want.
But we talked about the literary underground London and what's underneath. I mean, that's happening again because those very rich people are... they're just going deeper and deeper into the earth with these basements. And then that amazing thing that happens where they find an unexploded World War II bomb when they're digging down. So there's so much underneath.
There's such a gold rush in London property that this is a... And they've got the people that are coming in tend to have limitless funds. So the old London that we grew up in, where you kind of gradually edged your way up the property ladder, rung by rung, book by book, it's kind of gone. It's gone
right,
now.
Right, fascinating anomalies. At the top of the Bishop's Avenue throughout the late 70s was a large biker squat opposite Ken Wood with kind of people shagging in the front garden and getting loaded. It was great. But, you had those kind of... talking about the rebuilding here, we were talking about bomb sites. Old Street Roundabout was one big bomb site right up until the early 80s. It was just absolutely sold all there.
And there's that moment in Shepherd's Bush to Holland Park where you go from, poverty to some of the most expensive houses in London just in a couple of streets, and that kind of thing happens as you
walk. Always been one of the interesting things about the city, and that's because of the very rapid... the kind of people moan about gentrification, but think how you'd have felt if you were living in inner London, when the big Victorian speculative building boom happened. The house that I lived in for 20 years in South London, the 1880 census, it was built for an upper middle class family with servants. Mm. By the 1901 census, it's been subdivided into five flats. There's nothing new under the London sun, in a way. Yeah. And it can happen again.
Well, the difference is now that at those interstices, you now have it's a gated community. So the fact that it's...
Oh, but we had those
people...
as well.
It's come back.
Yeah. We've got two people with microphones. Gentleman over there and then lady there. Yes, first.
Hello. You talked a little earlier on about the change in the ethnic composition of London in the last few generations. And it seems to me that it's very difficult to write a London novel without embracing that. So I could ask the panel's views on how you might achieve that in a meaningful and convincing way.
Well, John Lanchester tried, didn't he, in Capital, where he has...
He did try, he tried to nail it. He tried to...
Have you read Capital or seen the TV version? Yeah.
And I thought
he tried it.
He moved his stereotype.
But he perhaps proved how impossible it is to do. But But he certainly tried to do it, where you go from millionaire footballers to
I'm wondering why it didn't work. I'm wondering why that book didn't, because I read it too, and I didn't think it worked. I thought he wrote brilliantly
about London property. All day long, you know, Berry Brothers and, you know, Amazon are bringing deliveries and they're like supplicants to these houses. I thought he did that better than the people. I spend a lot of time in Serbia because I sell a lot of books in Serbia. And I find them really lovely, warm, open-hearted people. And yet in movies and in books, they're usually the villains, Serbs are the villains. So I try to insert a few Serb heroes and nice people, kind, nice Serbians. So I think, you know, you subvert the cliches and you follow your heart. I think that's how you do it.
Yeah. I think, Paul and Pressburger, or particularly Pressburger in his script writing, because he was coming from Hungary and it became part of somewhere else, and then it was under the Germans, and then he came through France and he learnt multiple languages. They were very good at filmically presenting very quick vignettes with different people from different places, but they had a particular, I mean, as you say, they had a unifying idea behind that to say these are all people who are trying to do something, and they had a particular view of what humanity was, and they would even give you a U-boat captain who was in some way functioning as a human being. But I mean, Pressburger had a large exposure to lots of different cultures and understood them and understood multiple languages, so he could kind of do that. You'd need a real rooting, I think, in multiple cultures.
And I think the problem with Capital, the problem with that book is the author wrote about it as though it was just something that had recently happened, whereas I was in the Polish club last night around the corner from the Albert Hall, and there are pictures of Polish airmen who, you know, it's knocking on for 100 years now. And, you know, this city has got a really strong connection with Poland and the people of Poland. And it's not something that's just come in with the Premier League or come in with the 21st century. So I think the more you know about your city, the better it will serve you.
But I also think in this discussion, which I hadn't expected to come out, that it's perhaps the mistake is to try to write a London novel, that it has almost regional variations, because we talked about a course you might put together, that you have the Peckham Rye novel and you have the Ladbroke Grove novel and you have the South London novel.
And Dickens, you have the Kent Marshes. Yeah. And there's that sense of, you know, the country beyond the sea.
Well, Heart of Darkness is a great London novel.
Mm. And Secret Agent.
Secret Agent is a crack.
Greenwich novel. But just, am I right about this, that the distinction between the city and the counties, that is something that has changed, hasn't it? Because, like, Middlesex seemed part of London.
Well, Middlesex doesn't actually exist anymore.
No. And Essex, Essex and London, there was less distinction, wasn't there? Like, when your parents moved.
Well, I mean, just for you know, 30 or 40 years, there was that trail, which is not happening anymore. And there are people, you know, on that TOWIE, on that TV programme, The Only Way is Essex. I mean, these young people clearly identify with Essex. They think this is their place.
That's what I was getting at.
Yeah,
it was a sort of part of London, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's that. You know, there's
very nice sort of tight umbilical relationship between the city and Essex since the Big Bang in the 80s. So if you stand around Liverpool Street on a Friday night, you can actually sort of feel the drunken humming tension between there and kind of
you know, you go back to see your nan, and you would go back to see the people that hadn't left and that were and that's ended.
Very patient lady, yes.
Yeah, mine's not a question. I just wanted to speak up for a novel that hasn't been mentioned yet, which is George Gissing's New Grub Street.
Oh, yes.
And a wonderful account in which the hero's rise and fall is charted through his moves around London, from the respectability of Westbourne Park, where you can keep a carriage and your muse, to horror of horrors, his starvation in an attic in Islington.
Yeah. I'm sure somebody must have done it at some point, but I'm sure on a tube map you could stick, London Underground map, you could put a novel. But it is possible, I think. There must be one for everywhere now.
Yeah, just quickly, and leading on from this gentleman's question over here, thinking about John Lancaster and about, say, Zadie Smith, there seems to be this desire to write across class and across different cultural backgrounds. Do you feel a responsibility as London novelists to do this, or do you think it is okay, just like Patrick Hamilton, to write about one guy bumming around in a pub is that okay now, or with the sense of history behind us and how much the city has changed, you feel a big responsibility to have to write across class and across culture boundaries? Well,
you're quite right. Zadie Smith-Stan W, you should have mentioned. Yeah.
I've written with characters from different heritages from my own. I mean, I can do that shit. You know, I went to school, we had three moieties in the class. We called ourselves the Yocks, the Yids, and the Packies. And the Packies were all the kids who'd come in from the East African Asian exodus in the early 70s, and, you know, Gujarati and Punjabi kids who'd end up via Africa and come in. The Yids were the Yids, who'd come, of course, were in their own diaspora from the East End up to North London. And the Yocks were just Yocks, weren't they? No, I mean, I find this is a bit weird. I mean, aren't we talking about literature? We're not talking about marketing. I mean, I write what I want to write. If I come across a character and the character's from a different heritage and they have to be, then I'll work on it to the extent I need to. But I don't set out to write panoramic books that embrace the whole world. It's not a fucking Coke commercial. You know, it's like, what the fuck?
Well, I think that you shouldn't feel a responsibility, but it just makes, you know, it just gives it a bit more fibre, you know, that if as multi-generational as you can make it and just as varied as you can make it, but it should never be a strain. You know, it should be what fits your story. I think everything is a slave to the story. That's what I think. It's just everything is a slave to the story. It's what works for you, and you haven't got a responsibility to anybody or anything apart from your story.
But with Max Wolfe, did you always know it was going to be London?
Yeah, I was stuck in a lift with James Ellroy in Germany.
And it really
got me, and we were in this tiny little lift in Cologne, and it really got me thinking. It felt like about two or three months, but it was probably about 5 or 10 minutes. And I was thinking how important location is to Ellroy, and actually how important location is to any, specifically crime writers. You know, from Conan Doyle to Raymond Chandler it tends to work if you identify with a contemporary city, and so Max Wolfe had to be there, and then I was thinking about Fleming. I was thinking about that kind of wish fulfillment of what's a really cool part of London that I've never lived in, that I've always loved, and I've always loved Smithfield, always loved, always spent time there. So, you
meaty.
Know, I'm sorry?
Meaty.
Very meaty, yeah. Very
you don't
meaty.
Eat meat,
very
though,
very
do you?
Meaty. Not so much.
You spent a lot of time having breakfast there, didn't you?
I had a few breakfasts with you there.
Yeah.
So, I think location is fantastically important, specifically for crime novel. I never really thought about it until. And James Ellroy, I wanted to ask James Ellroy about. Location, the importance of location, the importance of a city, the importance of LA to him. I was a bit too shy, and in the end, all I could say to him was, "This lift is moving at a glacial pace, Mr. Ellroy." He said, "Listen, kid, when we started out, I still had hair," which I thought was a lovely James Ellroy.
I thought
I dropped a battery or something.
Yeah, don't worry.
I'll let you do it in a moment. Yeah. Hi there. So I tend to find anything about London in novel form dizzying when the geography gets too spread out. And to me, I think it was one of the greatest crimes ever that Peter Cook never got to do his book My London, which was just detailing his journey from his front door to William Hills on Hampstead High Street, which was all about 200 yards. And one of the books that's really done it for me for London in the last couple of years was Girl on a Train, because it literally was about 200 yards of a railway track in South London, and just the richness that can be brought out of just a microcosm of a location rather than, oh, this is leafy Islington, oh, look at the yummy mummies with their tractors. And so I like London when it's really melted down into something very, very tiny and very, very specific. And that's it. I'm not sure where I was going.
No, that's a good point. We haven't mentioned the commuting. In T.S. Eliot, I mentioned that amazing bit in The Wasteland where they all come across Waterloo Bridge.
You would have thought death had undone
the
so
death
many.
Had undone so many, yeah.
But I think we aspire to that Peter Cook London, you know, we aspire to that village that we love. You know, we aspire to that. I mean, I live in the same neck of the woods as him, and he's an absolute, he's like the patron saint of NW3, Peter Cork. He's really deeply, deeply loved. And I think that, I think a lot of it is people admire his life and envy his life that he didn't go far. You know, he didn't feel the need to go far. It was, why would he leave? Why would he leave Church Row?
He was just a hopeless alcoholic, Tony. What the fuck are you talking about? You're absolutely mad.
Sorry, Alison.
Yeah, but I mean, ideally, whatever you're writing about, it's going to organically fit, you know, all of the parts of it will fit organically. And I mean, hopefully, as a writer, whatever you're writing, if you were going to walk out of the building and get hit by a truck, you would have said the thing that burnt within you that you had to say. And it's not like it's going to be a canonical novel, or it's going to be a London novel, or it's going to be a Woman in Peril novel. It's going to be the thing that you have to write.
I think you write a great London novel engine. Or a good London novel by writing about the things that you love and the things that you're obsessed with and the things that hold your heart. And I think if you do that, I think that's the best. I after writing the first of these three books, I felt I couldn't do it again. I wasn't sure I could do it again. And my editor said, have you ever been to Highgate Cemetery? I said, oh yeah, everybody knows Highgate Cemetery. He said, no, the other side, not the side that Karl Marx is buried, but the west side, which is close to the public. She said, just have a wander around there and have a think about it. And it's completely different. The west side of Highgate Cemetery is this, you know, Victorian graveyard that's been reclaimed by nature. And it's incredible. And
Kensal Green Cemetery is another amazing one. Have you?
Yeah.
I think the monuments on the west side of Highgate, though, take the biscuit. I mean, there's entire sort of reproductions of Luxor in there. It's utterly bizarre.
And I think if you follow, you know, the London that you're interested in, then that's the best thing you can do. I think the worst thing you can do is to think, you know, I've got to replicate the ethnic makeup of the city and the way it's changed. I don't think you should do that. It's That's not how you proceed. You proceed with what holds your heart and what you love about the city. Because, you know, we all find our own London. Peter Cook is a great example because that was it for him, you know, stumbling from one end of Church Road to the other. And we all find our own London.
The last thing I want to discuss, because Will is at the end of his contract now, so we're about to go, is that we have...
I didn't even sign a contract. I could just piss off now.
We've talked about the London novel as a positive thing, but remember, I mean, that phrase that came to book reviewing in the 70s, the Hampstead adultery novel, which was seen as the worst thing, and was...
I've written lots of novels about adultery in Hampstead, actually.
But that was the idea that it was insular and...
Well, and also it was an idea that, you know, Hampstead was middle class... English people that probably read The Guardian, and it's kind of, you know, it's not like that anymore. They can't afford Hampstead.
I know, but the problem is, if you live anywhere near Hampstead and you shag somebody who you shouldn't, it's really going to weigh on your mind. And if you're a novelist...
you've got a book.
Exactly. So, I mean, why knock it? I mean, it's fine. I wrote a story called Volvo, Design Faults in the Volvo 760 Turbo. That's all about adultery in Hampstead. You can read it. Free on the internet.
Thank you very much to Will Self, Tony Parsons, A.L. Kennedy. Thank you to our panel. Thanks very much to all of you.
Thanks to A.L. Kennedy, Will Self, Tony Parsons, and Mark Lawson. Tony Parsons' The Hanging Club is out from Century. A.L. Kennedy's Serious Suite is published by Jonathan Cape. And Will Self's The Book of Dave is out from Penguin. We'll be running more literary discussions from our Guardian Live Events programme over the summer. You can find out more about them or book for future events by going to Guardian Live. Ian McEwan and Jonathan Safran-Foer are among our upcoming guests. Or you can listen to them all here in due course. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast. Until then, from me, Claire Armitstead, and my producer, Susanna Trezillian, thanks for listening.
This Guardian podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.